I would say the girls right now, 75% have intense substance abuse issues.
There are fewer juvenile offenders in Anchorage, but their problems are more severe. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the federal government proposes taking the humpback whale off the endangered species list.
That's a really important and success for us as a nation.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Children's Trust, working to prevent child abuse and neglect by encouraging all Alaskans to take small steps that can make a big difference in the lives of Alaska's children. Information at alaskachildrenstrust.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust.
In Anchorage, the number of criminal offenses by minors referred to the Department of Juvenile Justice has dropped by nearly half in the past decade for almost every offense type, except severe drug and alcohol offenses. That number has stayed fairly steady. In fact, as a share of the whole, substance abuse cases in Anchorage are up, but the numbers only tell part of the story. Each day this week, Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman and Zachariah Hughes are bringing you voices from behind the statistics in Anchorage, part of a series we're calling The Blind Spot. To start, we'll hear what that number of juvenile drug and alcohol offenses really means.
So to start out, I'm Zachariah.
And I'm Ann.
We got interested in whether there are more or fewer young people in Anchorage who are admitted to DJJ for problems with substance abuse than there used to be. It seemed like a simple thing to find out, especially because the state's Division of Juvenile Justice keeps track of data about what offenses are being committed and where.
And early on, it seemed straightforward. Every type of juvenile crime in Anchorage is dropping, except for crimes related to substance use. Total offenses went from about 3,500 in 2004 to just under 2,000 in 2014. Substance abuse-related crimes have always varied from year to year, but average around 190. Okay, so what does this all actually mean? To find out more, we took a tour of the McLaughlin Youth Facility in Anchorage, which houses about half the juvenile offenders in the state.
So, you know, if in my mind, if I'm thinking of a correctional setting, this is it.
Dennis Weston is the head of McLaughlin. He walks into an open-tiled room lined with jail cells. Each cell boasts a mat on a plastic bed, a steel toilet, and a small window. Weston has seen a lot change since starting as a detention officer in 1992. That includes a huge reduction in the number of juveniles the division handles at any one time. The number peaked in the 90s, when at a given day, McLaughlin would have up to 215 residents on its campus. Now, the Anchorage facility has half that number. That's partially because more moderate offenders are no longer getting sent to facilities.
Many kids who do arrive at McLaughlin are in crisis, and counselors immediately start evaluating whether they're a danger to themselves or others. Most have immediate trauma, behavioral disorders, or side effects from one or more substances, and some have trickier problems. Weston enters a sparsely furnished cell with a breathing machine next to the bed.
Henry came to us. He had serious medical concerns, sleep apnea with aggravating factors. You know, there's also some self-harm concerns, and there was some assaultive concerns. So you had the medical concerns, but you also had the behavioral concerns. But this was a big part of the problem, not getting any rest, not breathing correctly. And you have to monitor that. You have to have a staff sit there with the door open all night to make sure that equipment's being used as it's supposed to be.
So that's detention, which is short-term, 3.5 weeks on average. But McLaughlin also has a treatment wing, where generally kids stay 12 to 14 months. About 70 kids at any one time go through the treatment program, which is a big share of the 100 to 120 juveniles in treatment across the state in a given year. We head to a cottage on the McLaughlin campus where all the young women live. Nicole Charisma oversees the girls' treatment ward.
I would say the girls right now, 75% have intense substance abuse issues where they need to complete the intensive substance abuse group.
Girls make up just a quarter of referrals. The unit in McLaughlin is the only all-female treatment facility in the state. Charisma generally has each girl for a year and a half before they move into a six-month transition phase, preparing to go from an institutional setting back into the community.
So we try to make things as home-like as we can, and that's paired with the trauma-informed care. A lot of these girls have, and most of the youth in the facility have endured a lot of trauma, and so restricting pictures of family or restricting, you know, something like a stuffed animal that would make them feel comfortable or a blanket that their grandma made, we don't feel it's very conducive to treatment.
One of the things we found out at McLaughlin is that by the time kids are entering the DJJ system, most of them have gotten into trouble multiple times. For example, just look at alcohol-related offenses. The most common alcohol-related citation for young people in Anchorage is an MCA, minor consuming alcohol. You don't get referred to DJJ on your first MCA, you go for your third. And not that many MCAs are issued anymore. In 2009, there were just over 400. But by 2013, the last year numbers are available from APD, there were just 76. MCAs have dropped 83%. A department spokesperson says that doesn't mean fewer minors are drinking. Most MCAs are cited when police break up parties, and there's been less of that since investigations into noise complaints were downgraded to a lower response priority. The point is that by the time kids are logged in DJJ's stats in Anchorage for alcohol, they're coping with serious substance abuse issues, sometimes coupled with a lot of other problems, ranging from family issues to homelessness to self-harm.
So we became really interested in the space between the statistics, when young people may be drinking or using drugs, but before a major legal intervention happens. And we found a gap. There's no coordinated effort to track youth who have started getting into trouble and are having a hard time finding help to get clean. All this week, we'll bring you stories of individuals who have found their own routes for dealing with substance abuse, and some solutions different agencies are developing to prevent the problem from happening in the first place. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
And I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Alaska legislature missed its adjournment deadline last night after failing to reach agreement on the state's budget. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
It was certain by 8 p.m. that the legislature would not be gaveling out. A conference committee still had not met on the state's operating budget, and the usual buzz and urgency of the last day of session was missing entirely. Taking a break outside the Capitol, House Speaker Mike Chenault explained the holdup was a vote to draw from the Constitutional Budget Reserve to fill a multi-billion dollar deficit. Without support from the Democratic minority, the legislature is short at least three votes to tap the rainy day fund.
We get through it by negotiating with our minority on what they need to get out of here for a three-quarter vote. But yet, in turn, we're not going to add millions of dollars back into the budget that we don't agree with.
Making a deal of that scale is already hard enough, but compromise was further delayed by personal circumstances. That Sunday morning, the daughter of Democratic Minority Leader Chris Tuck and conservative talk radio personality Bernadette Wilson was born. Tuck flew back to Anchorage to meet the 7-pound Penelope Grace. Chenault, a Nikiski Republican, said that obviously could not be helped.
He's got a new baby girl. It might have been not the right time, but he did what I would have done in his place, and I would have went back and seen my wife and my child.
There are a few big sticking points in the budget negotiations. Democrats would like to see education funding restored, and they would like for the legislature to expand Medicaid. They also want to reverse some cuts to the ferry system, public broadcasting, and pre-kindergarten. Chenault says that if an agreement cannot be reached, a government shutdown is possible.
That's not something we want to see with our state employees. I don't believe that that's what the minority wants to see either. But, you know, that's the, I guess, nuclear option, if you want to call it that.
On the Senate side, Majority Leader John Coghill also spoke of grave consequences if a deal failed. The North Pole Republican said the legislature could try to fund government using the Permanent Fund Earnings Reserve, which requires a simple majority instead of a three-quarter vote.
There's a huge political reluctance to take that money because it has huge impacts on the dividends. But I can tell you that may be the very next thing we'll have to do.
The Permanent Fund Earnings is a deadly game. If they're going to play that game, I'm not going to participate in it.
Representative David Guttenberg and Representative Scott Kawasaki, both Fairbanks Democrats, object to the compromise being described in such stark terms. Kawasaki says their conditions for support of a budget reserve draw should not come as a surprise.
We talked about Medicaid expansion and reform. We talked about education that doesn't cut kids and opportunities. And we talked about seniors. I mean, we've talked about the same thing from the beginning.
Negotiations were still underway on Monday. While the legislative session is scheduled for 90 days by statute, the Alaska Constitution allows lawmakers to meet for 121 days without calling for a special session. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
In spite of the session extension in Juneau, the status of new legislation dealing with commercial marijuana for the year ahead is clear. Only one bill passed in both the House and Senate, the governor's bill to establish a marijuana control board similar to the body that regulates statewide alcohol permits, is slated to become law. Regulators and marijuana policy advocates listed the legislation as their top priority for the session, since it funds staff positions within the Alcoholic Beverages Control Board to begin writing rules before the first commercial licenses are issued in 2016. The total cost to fund the new board is just over $1.5 million. Other important pieces of legislation, including a broad change in the legal statutes governing marijuana, as well as a bill that would have given municipalities more control overseeing new marijuana businesses, either stalled in committee or were voted down. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, dancing in Bethel's Chamai Festival while suspended from the ceiling.
Thinking about breathing, being in the moment, and moving with the music. So that's the number one thing. And hanging on.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast offers an online occupational endorsement in financial institutions, covering banking and accounting concepts and principles. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
The federal government is proposing to remove most humpback whales from the endangered species list. 45 years after the whales were first listed, federal scientists say most humpback populations, including those common in Alaska, are stable and growing. Donna Weeding of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration calls it quite a big deal.
To be able to bring a species to a point where their population is doing well and they no longer meet those requirements to be on the Endangered Species Act, I think that's a really important and success for us as a nation.
NOAA announced the proposed rule today after a five-year review of humpback research worldwide. Humpbacks were hunted almost to extinction during the mid-20th century. One estimate puts the total population in the North Pacific at fewer than 1,500 whales by the mid-1960s. Now scientists estimate there are more than 21,000 humpbacks in the North Pacific and as many as 85,000 worldwide. NOAA says most protections will remain in place even if humpbacks are delisted. Whales in U.S. waters will still be protected by the Marine Mammal Protection Act, while outside the U.S., the International Whaling Commission maintains a ban on commercial whaling. NOAA's proposal would split the species into 14 populations and take 10 of those populations off the endangered species list entirely. That includes most of the whales that feed in Alaska waters. The public has 90 days to comment on the proposal, and NOAA has about a year to review public input and issue a final rule. Right now, a lethal strain of bird flu is wreaking havoc in the lower 48. It's clear that migrating flocks have something to do with spreading the illness between farms and across continents, but exactly what is still fuzzy. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, a remote spot in southwest Alaska may hold some clues.
The Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge is pretty far off the road system, unless you count the avian highways that run overhead.
Eisenbeck provides wonderful staging habitat for large numbers of migratory birds, both from Eurasia and North America. And so there's the potential for viruses to mix and be spread.
That's Andy Ramey, a researcher with the U.S. Geological Survey and the author of a new study on bird flu. Ramey and his colleagues wanted to figure out how migration might be helping the virus get around. So they visited the Eisenbeck Refuge every fall, when emperor geese and northern pintail ducks were passing through. Over 4 years, the team collected almost 3,000 swabs and fecal samples. None of them contained deadly flu, like the kind that's killing off poultry in the Midwest. But Eisenbeck did show an exact match for a harmless strain of bird flu that's only been found in China and South Korea. After some genetic tests,
what we found was these viruses were sort of hybrids. That is, they're essentially half Eurasian and half North American.
These mixed-up viruses aren't uncommon at the edge of the continent. Move further inland, though, and you're more likely to find pure ones. Ramey says that's what researchers have been looking for as they try to prove that migration's spreading bird flu. There's been a lot of effort
to find an apple in the basket of oranges or an orange in the basket of apples.
Finding a half-apple, half-orange virus in birds on both sides of the Pacific Ocean has never happened before, according to Han Ip. He's with the National Wildlife Health Center.
One possible mechanism of how this happened is that a Eurasian virus was brought by wild birds into Alaska, and a certain virus emerged from a co-infection there that now generated this combination virus, which has a little bit of Eurasian genes and some North American genes.
From there, it might have hitched a flight back to Asia with a migrating duck or goose, or it could have spread out from Russia. Either way, it's a long journey. But Ip and Ramey say there might be more versions of the bird flu out there taking a similar path. Going forward, Ramey wants to continue testing birds in the Eisenbeck Refuge to find out what kind of viral baggage they're bringing with them and what happens when it gets unpacked across borders. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
With the last of the snow melting off and Alaska headed towards summer, long-range forecasts indicate it could be a hot one. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
National Weather Service Alaska Climate Science and Services Manager Rick Toman uses computer models to generate long-term forecasts.
All point strongly towards significantly warmer than normal temperatures.
Toman describes extremely warm surface temperatures in the eastern Pacific and Gulf of Alaska as continuing to drive a balmy trend in Alaska. Toman says the other half of the weather picture, precipitation, is much harder to predict.
Some weak indications of potentially wetter than normal across at least the eastern interior and perhaps south central and into southwest Alaska as well. But those signals much weaker than the very strong indications for significantly warmer than normal temperatures for both May and for the early summer.
The mix of warmth, lightning, and rain determine wildfire potential, and Toman says that's even harder to forecast.
Whenever we see a significant indication for warm, definitely our ears perk up. But as we've seen recently, for instance, in the 2013 season, it can be very warm, but doesn't necessarily translate to a big fire season.
Wildfire season also fizzled last summer as the interior experienced wetter than normal conditions, including in Fairbanks, where a June, July, August rainfall record was set. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A bluff near Homer Waterfront partially collapsed yesterday morning. No one was injured, but portions of the road are now closed indefinitely. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver reports.
Just after 8 a.m. Sunday, about 100 feet of the eastbound lane cracked and collapsed down a steep bank, taking swaths of spruce and alder trees, fallen branches, and other debris sliding into Mud Bay. The road, like many of the main arteries in Homer, is maintained by the Department of Transportation. Peninsula District Superintendent for Maintenance and Operations, Carl High, says crews are on site, digging down below the road to find the source of the problem.
There was an introduction of water down below the normal road grade elevation, down several feet there, probably back in the old Pioneer days type strata. We've encountered a bunch of logs and stumps and stuff that were shoved off of there where the water was introduced into that layer. it supersaturated the embankment, and that caused the subsidence.
Homer City Manager Katie Kester says the city does not yet have a repair timeline from DOT, but she says the city is keeping its eye on the approaching summer season and the effects a closure like this could have on the local economy. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska Pacific University emphasizes teaching and research that engages the region's social, cultural, environmental, and geopolitical issues. The university's Early Honors program attracts academically advanced high school students who complete their senior year credits while also earning college credits as full-time APU students. This message sponsored by APU.
The House passed a version of Aaron's Law on Saturday. Now, three versions of the Child Sexual Abuse Prevention Bill are stuck in the Senate Education Committee as the legislature winds down for the year. Majority leadership has indicated there's no rush to pass the bill. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Republican Representative Tammy Wilson said deciding how to educate children about sexual abuse prevention should be done on a local community level and not mandated by state law. House Bill 44 would require public schools to provide age-appropriate K-12 sexual abuse education. Wilson says the legislature should be more concerned with what resources schools have when something comes up.
We have a 7-year-old who's been mistreated at home. Comes and says something to the teacher about it. Do we have the safety nets to be able to, and the people that we need to find out exactly what happened? Or does that child get taken immediately from the home, spiraling the family downward for something that might have been innocently said and nothing happened? Children say things.
Other opponents included Republican Representatives Dan Sadler, Shelley Hughes, and Wes Keller. They spoke on the floor against adding another unfunded mandate for school districts, exposing young children to problematic material, and said the bill would not solve the problems. Representative Mike Hawker said the bill imposes an inappropriate burden and additional liability on teachers who are not
professional psychologists. They are not behavioral health specialists. They are educators, and we are demanding that they be something they are not and are not trained to be.
The bill's sponsor, Republican Representative Charisse Millett, said almost half of the state school districts already teach sexual abuse prevention in grades K-12. The bill also includes prevention efforts against dating violence and gives parents the option of excusing their children from either. Millett acknowledges that parents who are the perpetrators of sexual violence may be the ones who opt their children out.
This may not be the linchpin that solves the epidemic. However, we know that every victim matters. If we can save one child, one teenager, I think we've done our job.
Millett also agreed with critics who said her bill was not perfect.
I'm not shaming anyone. I respect every single person's vote. I understand your concerns. I get it. It's not a perfect bill, but let's not let perfect get in the way of good.
The bill passed 34-6. It's in the Senate now. In January, Governor Bill Walker called for Aaron's Law to be on his desk and said last Thursday it's still a high priority. At a press conference, he said he'd consider including it in a potential special legislative session. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
The Chamai Festival packed the Bethel Regional High School gym for a weekend of dancing, singing, and celebrating life in the YK Delta. KYUK's Ben Matheson has the story on the performers who bring generations together through song and dance.
The Tuksuk Bay Nelson Island dancers include performers from fourth grade through high school. Senior Deanna Jimmy says dance is a way to keep their culture vibrant.
It's really important to keep our culture going, so we try to speak to them in Yupik, encourage them to talk in Yupik.
The festival honored dancer, educator, and advocate Chuna McIntyre with the Living Legend Award. He's the founder of the Nunamta Dancers.
Dancing is like breathing, you know. You do it because you it's part of you. It keeps you going, you know, it keeps you alive.
Tuksuk Bay teenager Byron Nikolai's 15,000 Facebook fans would not fit into the Bethel gym, but it was clear that he had a lot of real-life likes. Performing with silk strung from the gymnasium ceiling, one performer defied gravity. Athabaskan and Tlingit, Crystal Worrell has a background in ballet, but for the last year and a half, she's been intensely studying aerial performance.
As an aerialist, you always have to think about your entire body, especially your feet. Are my feet pointed? I'm very finicky about my feet, so I'm like in my feet a lot. And I'm also just thinking about breathing, being in the moment, and moving with the music. So that's the number one thing. And hanging on.
Late Saturday evening, 19-year-old Mary Kernak was crowned Miss Chamai. Originally from Nepakiak, Kernak also has family in Holy Cross. She graduated last year from Bethel Regional High School. She's currently working in Bethel and saving up to earn both her pilot's license and go to college. She ran on a platform of suicide awareness and prevention and promoting a drug and alcohol-free lifestyle. Sylvester Ayik of the King Island Dancers was born and raised on the island.
It bonds the unity among the King Island community, even if they were not in King Island anymore. And song and dance, you know, help to keep us as one.
In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, you can find them online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Ben Matheson in Bethel. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.